I'm Peter Nash. I teach Hebrew and Hebrew Bible at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Evanston, Illinois, which is, as it says on our business cards and our stationery, a graduate theological seminary of the United Methodist Church located on the Northwestern campus. Our vice president for administration wants everybody to know that. Now it's official. It's into the record. This is the first of five sessions on the Joseph story, and the question that I'm asking myself is, and therefore will be forcing you to help me answer, is this a theology of victory or a theology of oppression? And I think the answer is it switches midstream, where Joseph goes from victim to oppressor. And when I did this, worked on Joseph last, it was 5 years ago, and it was at the end of my first year of teaching, and I hadn't quite joined the establishment then. And I was much more convinced that Joseph was only the victim. Now, 5 years later, with a little more realization of how much power I wield over students, how I can say something which I think is a kindly reminder, like don't forget the exam next week, sends them into a titter and is really quite an oppressive comment. I'm much more aware of how we all participate, no matter where we are in the structure. We have some above us and some below us. And as our situations change, we have to be mindful of how we use that power in relationship to one another and in relationship to the whole community. I teach Old Testament. Some of you have heard some of this last week, and I'm sorry you have to listen to it again. I teach Old Testament in Hebrew, and therefore we're going to talk about Old Testament this week. I realize that some people don't feel like it's really Bible study unless we talk about the New Testament, or at least how the Old Testament relates to the New. But you really don't want to hire a plumber when you need an electrician, or an electrician when you need a plumber. And since this week you've got an Old Testament person, we're pretty much focused there. I am an ELCA pastor, and therefore am committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ. But when I stand up professionally to teach, you hear only a little bit about how this works into the New Testament life. And I say that, one, as a warning, two, as an explanation of where I'm headed, because I'm going to ask you to take off those New Testament filters that we so often read with for part of the time here to try to get a better picture of what the scripture was that Jesus and the early church read. Remember with me, at least for this moment, that when Jesus talked about scripture, he was talking about the law and the prophets. He didn't know, if he did know, he wasn't telling us that a man named Saul would change his name to Paul and write the epistles. Didn't know which of his disciples, if any, would write down his biography, which we have in the Gospels. So when he spoke of Scripture and exhorted us to heed Scripture, it was the collection of books which we now call the Old Testament that Jesus spoke of. So that's my little apology in the old sense of what we'll be doing this week. And that's another one of those places you're welcome to call me to account if you feel you need to. I neglected to ask when we start if anyone needs help hearing, anyone need one of those little amplifiers, personal amplifiers? Great. That doesn't make any difference that I forgot. Or no one can hear me asking and it doesn't make any difference anyway. Okay. The plan for this week is to move pretty much straightforward through the Joseph story and highlighting Joseph's moments of victory and is moments of victimization, or as I actually have here in my scribble here, his moments as victim and his moments as victimizer. Today we'll look at the story, the whole book of Genesis quite quickly, and then a thumbnail sketch of the book of Joseph. And I'm going to ask you, when you get some time, I know that some of you don't have as much time as others, some of you have small kids here, but take a look at Genesis 37, 39, and then 39 through 50. We're going to skip over the 38th chapter, because it Joseph doesn't come up there at all, and it's sort of a meanwhile back with the other brothers part of the story. It is related to the Jacob cycle, but it's we're not going to get through all of the Joseph story this week anyway, so we'll leave Judah and Tamar to someone else, unless you have questions about it. Someone in the staff Bible study does have questions about it, so tomorrow we'll talk about that some, probably. And if you want to, we can too. We do have more chairs. And there are, for those of you who haven't picked up Bibles, there are Bibles on the blue table. Well, an overview of the book of Genesis. Genesis is a collection of stories of differing genres or types that are quite masterfully woven together to give a theological interpretation. Notice I said a theological interpretation of the beginning of the universe, the beginning of humankind, the beginning of political and social institutions of the ancient Near East and Israel in specific, and the beginning of the nation of Israel. Some of the types of literature, or the genres, as those in the clique call them, are sagas, epics, etiological tales. I wrote etiological tales up here this morning because it's the easiest to explain and the hardest to spell. And as we'll be looking at this week, a short novel, or as we call it in the field, a novella. Does that have anything to do with me, or is that just... I guess not. We moved a microphone and hurt poor Lo's ears before some of you got here. When she shows up at the door, I want to make sure we're not doing anything else to discomfort her. So I'll begin with etiological tales. They're short tales in general, brief narratives about an encounter. Very limited number of characters, usually very limited space, only 3, 4, 5 verses. And the etiological tales explain how something came to be, how a name came to be for a place or a person, or how a custom came to be. Best example comes to mind for how a custom came to be is in when Jacob wrestles with the angel all night long and winds up limp in the morning. We get this wonderful story. And then there's just this little tagline that says, and this is why the Israelites don't eat the meat from the sinew of the hip from any animal, because Jacob was made lame there. So that's an etiological tale. The tale explains how a custom came to be. His own name, Yaakov, means the grabber. He got that name early on because as the twins came out, the second of the twins grabbed the ankle of the older twin. And then the story goes on to tell us throughout that he was a grabber throughout his life, snatched several things of his brother's, most of which were more important than his brother's ankle. And then in that same story, after he wrestles with the angel, his name is changed from Jacob to Israel because he has struggled Yisar with God, El, Yisrael, one who struggles with God. So another etiological tale. A saga follows the progress of an individual, or in most cases here, a family. There are a few characters who interact with him or her. Abraham is a great example of a saga. 12, 13 verses of the book of Genesis deal with it through a variety of other genres woven together. There are etiological tales and epics, legends that move us through Abraham's life. And they're woven together to give us a narrative picture. But the plot is pretty complicated. It goes up and down and around because there are so many different pieces to fit together. An epic, well, Genesis 1 and 2, two stories side by side, with a cosmic scheme, a broad overarching scheme that tells us about how the whole universe came to be, and then the relationships that humanity has to that creation. And then finally, we've already mentioned a novella, a short novel. It's a fuller characterization. We get more of a picture of who at least some of the characters are. There tend to be more characters who get filled out. In the Joseph story, we get Joseph. We get a picture of him and who he is and how he relates to people. His father, Jacob, who he is and how he relates to his sons. Some of the brothers, at least Reuben and Judah, get filled out some. Potiphar doesn't get filled out very much, but Mrs. Potiphar, we get a picture of her. I call her Mrs. Potiphar because she's yet another one of those women in Scripture who never gets named, who do so much to make life itself possible, but very few of them get named. Mrs. Potiphar is one of them. We get some insight into her character or lack thereof. A little bit of Pharaoh, and then more of Joseph and more of his brothers. We have a pretty much a straight plot line. It goes up, and then it comes down, and builds to the climax, and then flows out of the story and to the next section. So it looks a little different from the saga or the epic. Questions or comments about that brief picture of the kinds of literature that we find, or some of the kinds of literature that we find in Genesis? Okay. How do we look at the way this masterful book, as I've said, has been woven together? Well, there are two. I'm going to give you two of the many ways that we can look at it. One is thematic, and when you look at the themes of the book, and there are different ways to do this. I'm just going to mention one. One is by broad content. So in Genesis 1 through 11, we have the primeval history, the sort of pre-time story of how things were before we really started keeping records as far as the Israelites were concerned. And it flows from the creation, and there are two stories there of creation, one where God simply speaks and one where God sort of gets down on hands and knees and plays in the mud and forms the human being and starts there. Then there's the spread of humanity and the first sin, and then the spread of humanity, and along with the spread of humanity comes the destruction, followed by a new creation, the destruction being the universal flood with Noah, and then the new creation, again with the same charge to Noah that Adam and Eve had, be fruitful and multiply, and with a subsequent spread of humanity. And they leave us off at the end of the primeval history with two stories side by side of how humanity and problems spread, and that this problem of sin has not been at all eradicated by the flood, because we get the story of the Tower of Babel. Well, let's make a name for ourselves is the cry in Genesis 11, and God's response is to confuse the language and to send people out in different directions. And so that people were not able to communicate with one another. Quite a punishment that we've brought upon ourselves. And along with that, in Genesis 10, the Table of Nations, where we simply hear that these are the sons of Noah and the sons of Shem, and they went this way and that way, and did this, took up this sort of craft and that sort of craft, and a fairly different picture, side by side, of how humanity is spreading out throughout the world, from the side of the mountain where the ark landed and Noah planted the first vineyard. Well, that's the primeval history. Then there's the Abrahamic saga, Genesis 12 through 25. So it's such a hurry to get to Joseph that I keep putting him in everywhere. Where Abram is called, there's a covenant, man, name change, covenants made of the promises of offspring and land and prosperity. And then we have this constant, within this saga, we have this constant theme of threat to the seed. We think we have seed, we think we have offspring in Lot, but we've got to make it clear, no, it's not a near relative, which was a way that property and name were perpetuated in the ancient Near East. So Lot is sent off after a minor dispute with among the herdsmen. Then we have the crisis of fertility. Well, she was already old. They were already old when they left and beyond the way of women, as it said with Sarah. We hear that she is barren. So we go to another route, her servant, and the birth of Ishmael, and then the first conflict with Sarah and Hagar, and then the birth of Isaac, and then another threat to the perpetuation of the family with the near sacrifice at Mount Moriah. And then we move, once he is born, we move into the Isaac cycle, which is a sub-cycle of the Abrahamic saga, where we pretty much just hear about him having a wife and having children and having one near miss that was very similar to his father's and mother's near miss with, no, she's not my wife, she's my sister. Here, you take her, Your Eminence. But that story gets repeated, happening, it recurs in Isaac's life. I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And that story is one of intergenerational strife. First of all, big strife is how are we going to get to the next generation? We're already old. We're already away from family. How are we going to preserve this? The servant isn't going to work. The nephew isn't going to work. The reproduction through the maid servant isn't going to work. My goodness, we're really in a jam. So first, just getting a seed is a problem. just getting an offspring is a problem. Getting to the next generation, and then terrible confrontation of the father being asked to sacrifice that son, and that what I regard as a really wretched test of faith. And then in the Jacob saga, we have intergenerational strife. Most of the strife that we see is between the brothers. We see it immediately at the birth of these two twins. It's redundant, isn't it? See it immediately at the birth of these twins. And the naming. And then they're separate lifestyles. One a man of the fields who would be very much at home in Holden, and one the man of the household and be back very happy away from Holden and in the library. And here we have all kinds of deception. A theme that runs through this Jacob cycle is deception at every opportunity. It seems that if you have a choice between the truth and a lie, you tell the lie, or you fix the deck. Jacob grabs from the beginning. He bargains for his brother's birthright. Being a second son, I don't think that's quite so bad. But then to go into and to deceive the father with hair shirt on and disguised voice to obtain the blessing, Then he has to flee for his life. Then we hear the story of his marriage and how his uncle, good old Uncle Laban, or cousin Laban, whichever, it's hard to tell with the terms for relationships. If he has an opportunity to deceive, he does. Jacob works for 7 years for Rachel and gets Leah. Works another 7 years and finally gets Rachel, and things are just going tremendously for Laban because Jacob is there. And when it comes time for Jacob to take his share, Laban always has something up his sleeve. So what finally transpires is, after some fiddling with the stock market, Jacob and Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah and all the kids sneak off in the middle of the night. So there's a flight for property. And then Laban shows up and they finally make a covenant that seems to last. Simple one: go ahead, take it, it's yours. Yeah, this was a bad deal, but be good to my daughters and my grandsons, or my grandchildren. There is one girl that gets mentioned there. Then Jacob confronts his past, and we've already talked about, just briefly, about wrestling with the angel. And then we move on to what happens with the sons once Jacob gets straightened out with Esau. That story in itself is a marvelous one, but the Jacob story, I mean, but within that story comes the novella of Joseph, which we'll move to as soon as I finish what I'm doing, which is, we've talked about the thematic approach. It's hard to believe I've done this once already this morning, and I'm still so Monday. Any questions about that sort of thematic rush through Genesis? Or comments? Well, we might get out early this morning. One of the structural approaches to Genesis has been to look at the generations of. There's just a Hebrew phrase, Ele Toledot. These are the generations of, and then whatever comes, whoever's name or whatever phrase comes next. And there are 10 of them marked by that phrase, and many authors believe that there actually are 11 and that the book starts with one that just doesn't get listed that way. So Genesis 1, 2 through 3, the first creation story, Genesis 1 through 2, 3, the first creation story is an unmarked generations of. And then Genesis 2, 4, through 4:26 begins with Ele Toledot, Shemayim v'Haaretz. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth. Then the third one is Genesis 5:1 through 6:8. These are the generations of the book. This is the book of generations of Adam. The fourth is Genesis 6:9 through 9:29, the generations of Noah. The fifth is the generations of the sons of Noah, and that's 10:1 through 11:9. The generations of Shem is the sixth one, and that's Genesis 11:10 through 26, and that's straight genealogy in that case. Shem is one of the sons of Noah, I guess. That's redundant too, because those are the only ones left at that point. The seventh is the generations of Terah, who is Abraham's father, or Abram's father. And that's the long one. It's 11:27 through Genesis 25:11. And interestingly enough, Abraham doesn't get that catchphrase, that introductory remark. There's no Ele Toledot Avraham. These are the generations of Abraham. But he fits into his father's family in good ancient Near Eastern style. The eighth is the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son with Sarah's handmaid, the Egyptian Hagar 25:12-18. The ninth is the generations of Isaac, and this is interesting in a sense. It's 25:19-35:29, and most of that is actually concerned with Jacob, even though it's 37:2, the 11th, where we actually get these are the generations of Ele Toledot Yaakov, these are the generations of Jacob. But most, there's only really one chapter, 26, I think. 25 is concerned, I believe. With the closing off of the life of Abraham, and 26 is the only real chapter that deals with Isaac, and then we move back into Jacob's story. The 10th is a short one chapter on the generations of Esau, mostly again genealogy, the cousins of Israel, so to speak, or some of the cousins of Israel. And the 11th, as I've mentioned, is where we start off our story. The generations of Jacob, which is really the beginning of the Joseph story. So frequently in this structural scheme, the person who's mentioned is not the person who gets all the press. Much like the book of Samuel, or the books of Samuel, as we have them in our canon. Joseph Heller, couldn't remember his name from it. The man who wrote Catch-22 wrote a book called That's going to be a long day. He wrote a book about David. And David bemoans the fact that he doesn't get a book in the Bible named after him. His story all shows up in Samuel.
Just think how encouraging that is to us who have wet hair.
Well, there's a blessing in everything, I guess. As we'll see in the Joseph story. There's mixed blessings. Well, the structural approach, are there any questions about this idea of structural approach to the text? Basically, what you do is you look for things that frame stories or frame sections, and in this this approach we've got sections that vary vastly in size, but they all begin with Ele Toledot, and then these are the generations of X. Some people have argued that actually the sections end with this, so that you're not starting the story with Ele Toledot, you're ending the story with this has been. But it doesn't work out quite as well, because very often they do show up afterwards. My father would be upset if his story were ended only because my professional or adult life began, and I can see his point, since I have a couple of children now. Although I'm getting very used to being Carrie's dad or Theo's dad. The structural approach is helpful, but it's mostly helpful for scholars or professionals in the field, and I think the thematic approach is one that's more helpful to the general reader. When I talked about the themes, I just mentioned a couple by personages and by themes like deception or which generation, whether you're working within a generation or whether you're working through generations. There are lots of different things. People have made their careers in Genesis working on the theme of blessing, for example, and others on the theme of covenant in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. So the thematic approach is also very helpful for the general reader. It's also picked up pretty strongly by the scholarly community. So I just wanted you to see what different ways you could look at Genesis and where we're going to jump in. Fortunately for us, the Joseph story works both ways. It's part of clearly part of the Jacob cycle or the Jacob saga, and it starts off with one of these structural markers, Elah Toledot. This is the generation of Jacob. So I think we're on firm ground, and we can go ahead and start to look at the story, unless as soon as we answer any questions or hear any comments. If I've bored you with that introduction, I apologize. It's just that when I teach seminary students, so often they don't know the story. So we got to tell it before we can start work. What I'd like to do for just the next few minutes is point out a couple things about the Joseph story. Again, ask you to read it, at least the first couple of chapters for tomorrow, and start some questions percolating in your mind. In the first couple of chapters, this phrase, God was with him, or the Lord was with him, comes up way too much for my comfort, because it comes up one of the really nasty places it comes up is when he's in prison. And I don't think of that as a place most often. It's not a place where I want to go to worship. Although Chuck Colson and others have found it, and I'm not saying this facetiously, I really found it as life-producing. That was when they were up against that wall that they experienced the presence of God. But there are a couple of really tacky places where Joseph, we're reminded that the Lord was with Joseph. One of them is when he's at what seems to be the absolute pits, literally, because the prison is called a pit, as well as the pit that is, the well that his brothers threw him in, is called a pit. It's not said in that place, but it's clear that the Lord was with him. As well as in the places where things are going very well. When he's sold into slavery, the story that we hear is he got to this already well-to-do Egyptian's house because he could afford a slave, right? He has to be well-to-do. The Lord was with him and the house prospered. So much so that the guy didn't pay any attention to what was going on. Just as long as he liked the food that was on his table, he was happy. And that's the other place in these first couple of chapters when Joseph is making things go very well. The Lord is with him. I also have a problem with being the enslaved head of a household away from home and the phrase coming back that the Lord was with him because this guy was doing well. But I guess it could have been worse for Joseph. And it probably was for many, many Israelites, or at least Palestinian, let's get back into the right historical perspective, Canaanites, who were sold or stolen into slavery in Egypt. And then the theological high point of the story, and this is a paraphrase, when he finally confronts his brothers after teasing them for months, and really tormenting them in what looks like an act of revenge. He says, don't beat yourselves up. I've already done that, is the subtext that I read. God sent me ahead to preserve life. That's the important thing to remember at the center of this story. It's like God has sent me to this place to preserve life. Well, what's the threat to the seed here? If like some say, the story of Genesis is the threat to the perpetuation of the Abrahamic covenant. It's the famine. Jacob has. We've been through the story already of Jacob and his son, and how in earlier chapters of how he had all these wonderfully harmonious sons. And after Joseph has been sold into slavery by his loving brothers, there comes a famine in in Canaan, and they heard that there was food in Egypt, and so they went down. But once again, I've gotten ahead of myself. Let's look at the beginning of the Joseph story. Questions or comments? And they can do to help this stuff settle in a little better. Genesis 37:2. This is the history of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a lad. He was a lad with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought him an ill report. To their father. What a nice kid. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a long robe with sleeves. Many of you will remember that as the multicolored, many-colored coat. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him even more and could not speak peaceably to him. Joseph, a 17-year-old with one gift already, a coat from his father that's gotten him into trouble. And then five, now Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they only hated him more. And he said to them, "Hear this dream which I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered round it and bowed down to my sheaf." Well, since this is a brief overview, we'll come back to this tomorrow, but since this is a brief overview, we'll stop there. He's got two gifts. He has the gift of dreams. This dream, and the brothers bow down, and the next dream, his, not only his brothers, but his parents bow down to him. The father rebukes him, but remembers it, keeps it in his heart, much like Mary did with the word about Jesus. And as we'll see later, he has a third gift, the gift of interpretation. Now, it seems that the gift of interpretation is not a gift to Joseph alone. And later on, we'll talk about how that's apparently a slap at the Egyptian magicians, that they can interpret dreams. Because as we see in this story, when he tells the dream to his brothers, they have absolutely no problem interpreting it and draw exactly the right conclusion from it. But the comment there, I think, is that the gift of interpreting dreams is one that comes from God, and not that one that comes through the magical powers of human beings. Well, God may be with Joseph, but his brothers are not. Up in verse 4, those of you who were here for part or all of last week heard a lot about shalom from me and from the group that was here, and surprisingly from Scripture itself. And the last phrase that's translated in the RSV about Joseph, about the brothers, is, "and could not speak peaceably to him." They were out of shalom. They were out of proper relationship, even in the most concentric, the smallest of concentric circles. The first place where there's supposed to be shalom, within the community, it's not there. And this carries forward this idea in the Jacob cycle of this theme of strife within the generation. They can't even ask, "How are you doing?" They can't even present the pretense of an all-Jewish family or all-Israelite family. There must be a word for that. Sort of the all-American family. They can't even pretend it in public. They won't even say, "How are you doing?"
Yeah, the Jerusalem Bible translators, they could not say a civil word to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's... meanwhile, back at the ranch, things are tough. Well, they are looking constantly for their opportunity to... the other thing about this is that they're at the same level. With the exception of the older, the eldest brother, they're all pretty much at the same power level. I mean, they're all men now. Joseph himself is 17. So we're not talking about baby brother who you can push around and beat up and is going to tag along. They're all pretty much, in Israelite culture, or ancient Near Eastern culture, they're all adult men. And the older brother has more power, and there is a pecking order, but they're all on the same plane with relationship to their father. And they're constantly looking for a way to grab some more of the power. Joseph, we've heard, is out of that relationship or out of that power structure because of his birth order and the mother who bore him. And the brothers don't like that, and they're constantly looking for a way to fix it. And when dad sends the brother out to check on the shalom of the older brothers and of the flock, it's a wild goose chase. It ain't there, so he can't find it. And as soon as they see him coming, they seize upon the opportunity to get rid of him. So they sell him into slavery. And Joseph becomes the major domo in Potiphar's house. And then we hear this phrase, God was with him, and there's this meteoric rise in the goods and property, apparently, or at least the organization of the household. And he runs into a tough decision. The woman of the house says, I want you, you're attractive, you work for me. And his response is, you're the only thing in the house I don't have charge over. He says, everything else is here for me to run, but you are not part of that responsibility. I can't sin against God and my master this way. And she doesn't like that. She sets him up, and he winds up in prison. And interestingly enough, we'll talk about this some tomorrow, her response to this shows that already racism of a sort was playing into it. Her response is, look what the Hebrew whom he has brought into our house to mock us has done, as she holds up his cloak. There's a lot of clothes changing here. As you read through the story, watch for the change of clothing as people change their status. As Joseph's status changes, watch for the change of clothing. He goes to prison. God is with him. Things go well. He's put in charge of the whole prison. And he begins to interpret the dreams, not his own dreams, but interpret dreams for the high and mighty who don't have this gift that he has because they don't know the God that he knows. Of course, when you do someone a favor, they return the favor. The last thing that Joseph says to the cupbearer when he gives the interpretation that in 3 days you'll be back in your cupbearership, as the Hebrew says, is to remember me. And of course, when he has returned to his cupbearership, he doesn't remember him because Joseph can't do anything for him now as far as he's concerned. Several years later, when the king is at wit's end over his dreams and all the magicians have failed, all the interpreters have failed, they've cut open all the chickens and all the doves and cast their innards out and can't get a decent interpretation. And they need at least a scapegoat, if not an answer. The cupbearer says, oh, when I was in prison, remember when you were mad at me? Send me to prison. There was a Hebrew there. I think his name was Joe. He interpreted my dream. Why don't you get him up here? Well, Joseph comes up and interprets the dream. And At the end of the interpretation of the dreams about the seven prosperous years followed by the seven lean years, which will gobble up the produce of the seven prosperous years, Joseph has this little tagline. He says, and this is what you should do. You should appoint a man to oversee this collection of the produce and the distribution of the produce during the lean years. And the king responds, oh, I've got the candidate right in front of me. You're the man. So he becomes, in Joseph's words, a father to Pharaoh. Much parallel to the situation in the house of Potiphar, where there's only one thing that he doesn't have control over, in the house of Pharaoh, he has control over everything, except for the Pharaoh's own household. Everything else in Egypt is under Joseph's control. So another nice piece of structuring in this little novella. And that gives him the opportunity to repay his brother's kindness, because after these seven great years of production in Egypt comes the famine. It hits not only Egypt, but the whole world. And Jacob is struggling with his remaining sons in Canaan. And he says, I've heard that there's food in Canaan, or in Egypt. Go down that we might not die, but live. Go down and buy us some food. And then we get this really wrenching story of a tormented man, Joseph, separated from his people, his very brothers and father, and one sister that we hear about. Also filled with rage about what has been done to him by his brothers. And he sets out to find out just how these people have changed and to find out how much he's changed by his years in Egypt. He puts them to several tests, and finally, when he can't carry the charade through any longer, breaks down in tears, and that's when he utters these words, words similar to this. God sent me ahead to preserve life, which is exactly Jacob's plan. Go down and buy grain that we might live and not die. There are a couple of high points in this story, depending on what your interest is. If you're a straight political leader, a straight story reader, then this elevation to vizier in chapter 40 or 41 is the high point of the story. It's really the Horatio Alger story has really, he's up there. He's gone from prison, literally the pit, up as high as anyone can go. If you're one of two theological modes, then this is the high point, when there's the confrontation and the confession and the statement about the sovereignty of God. If you're of another theological interpretation, the high point comes in the blessing of the 11 of the 12 sons, actually, the 12 tribes, the sons who become the tribes. Joseph gets moved out of the picture, and his two sons become tribes in the scheme of things, in the Israelite 12 tribe system. And the blessings that come to the son, for some authors, are the high point of this story. So there are lots of ways to read it, and I'm going to throw in a fourth, ignore some of those others and throw in a fourth. What you'll hear from me are some skewed analogies to the Joseph story that I see in 20th century America, especially for people of color, people who do work in a culture that has not yet become their own. Most of the groups who have come to the United States have gone through this to some extent, but since people of color are immediately identifiable, the stuff has gone on longer, and the circling in upon one's own family has become in some ways more vicious, and that's what we'll be banging away at. That's my subversive approach to the text, as some theologians call it. Questions or comments before we go today? Yeah.
Well, to go back to the story of Abraham needing to be willing to sacrifice Isaac, you made a comment that I didn't quite, you didn't explain at all, but you had some adjective to describe that. That demand of God on Abraham.
Wretched, was that it?
Right. Right.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I didn't wait years and years and years to have children. But if I perceived call from God to sacrifice my child, I mean, literally to sacrifice my child, to take either my son or my daughter to a mountaintop and kill them on an altar, I would have serious problems with God. Because Abraham doesn't know until the last minute that there's going to be any reprieve, any commutation or whatever you want to call it, any stopping of that action. So he's His son, his only son, his beloved son, they're going on a little field trip together. And there are all kinds of things as the story moves along. The son says, "Where is the ram?" And Abraham says, "For the sacrifice, God will provide," knowing full well that it's his son that is going to be sacrificed, or believing that his son is going to be sacrificed. So I find that pretty tough from the father's point of view. Now think about it from the son's point of view.
I agree that it's wretched from their point of view. My question was, did you imply that that was unfair of God? I guess that's the thinking that came to me as you used that word, wretched.
Did I imply that it's unfair of God?
Maybe that isn't what you meant by wretched.
Well, let me skip out of my own caveat and say, that's the kind of sacrifice I think should be left to God. One of the constant prohibitions in Israelite writings is the prohibition against human sacrifice. They thought it was wrong. We certainly think it's wrong. If we read in the newspaper, New York Times, Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Chicago Tribune, that someone went up on Copper Mountain or someplace in the Appalachians or the Catskills and killed his son and came back down and said, "God said to do it," we'd lock him up so fast. There's no way I can understand it. And the only way I can begin to make peace with it is to say, all right, years later, generations later, God made that sacrifice. To ask it of humans, I think it's unfair. I think it's, I just infuriated. I just finished reading a history of the Vietnam War. And just to think of what, my college classmates, high school classmates, not so many of my college classmates, because if they got to college, they didn't take us at that point. How they were sacrificed in Vietnam for absolutely nothing. Now, it's a very different sort of point, but a human life is a human life. And to ask a father or a mother to make that sacrifice under any circumstances is far more than I can comprehend and think of as fair. One response is it's a gift given freely and freely taken back, but I'm not that mature. You had a question?
Yeah. In the beginning, you were talking about it is a theology of despair or defeat or of victory.
Mm-hmm.
I see much more than that a theology of hope, where eventually everything turns out well, where God is defeating all these evil things men are doing to Joseph,
mm-hmm.
and turns it into God working through good and evil.
Yeah. The part that I want to focus on with that question of a theology of despair or a theology of victory, a defeat or victory, is what Joseph does when he gets power. What the powerless does when he obtains power. That part of it. So I'm looking at, that's still another point. I'm not this high point, and not the high point of Joseph comes to power, but then how does he treat the ones who have mistreated him? And not only the ones who have mistreated him, but just the ones who happen to be under his power because there's a famine, and he has the authority granted by the king. Any other comments or questions?
And isn't that the recurring fear, the theme through history, of the oppressed coming to power, what, in that sense of the whole fight?
Yeah, there's a saying, and Wolfgang Roth says it. I don't know where he picked it. I know that he didn't write it, but he always credits whoever actually wrote it down. So I'll credit Wolfgang, my colleague in Old Testament. And you can write him and ask him. Yesterday's liberators are today's oppressors. And that is very much a problem throughout. And I see some real problems with that in the African-American community, all of the communities of color. And in the Anglo communities, where we should know better. I mean, the Irish in Chicago should know better than to run a political machine the way Richard Daley Sr. did. That was really plantation politics. I mean, if anybody in this country knew how bad it was to be on the downside of the political and economic structure, it was the Irish. And yet the Irish had absolutely no problem, and still have no problem to some extent, doing that in Chicago. And then within that, there are groups within the black community that have no problems with using the little bit of power that they have. Sometimes it's considerable, to really take advantage of less fortunate African Americans.
And I think for the person that's in power, that's an ongoing fear, controlling force to not allow anyone to have any sort of balance in the following law.
Mm-hmm.
Because of exactly that.
Yeah. One of the things that we've seen in 30 years of things like affirmative action and integration is that the real conflicts don't come at 50-50. If a congregation is changing, the conflict doesn't come when the balance is about to tip from 50 Swedes and 50 blacks or 50 Norwegian and 50 Hispanics or whatever. The real conflict comes at about 15%. When blacks or Hispanics or Swedes, if it's a Norwegian congregation, or Norwegians, or Danes, whatever. But that's where the real struggle begins, because it's apparent that certain parts of the power are beginning to move out of one's control. And it really...
Male-female?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these studies are really well documented that in this room, in most settings, with this kind of a mix, men will ask many more questions than women. Men will dominate the conversation much more than women. And it just closed with an example from Hebrew. If we were to talk about this group, and you were to stay here and all the other men were to leave, the convention of Hebrew, both in the ancient world and today, is that I would address this group of one man and 20 women as if it were a male group, because Hebrew distinguishes masculine singular, feminine singular, masculine plural, feminine plural, and as long as there's one male in the group, it gets addressed as a male group. There's no There's no neuter. So it happens that way. But that's a quirk of language, but the studies are really very well established that in most situations, if there are men in the group, they will dominate the conversation. thanks for your attention and your time, and I hope we have a productive week.
Assuming it was written for later generations to...